A measure circulating on Capitol Hill would allow Medicare to negotiate directly with drug makers over the price of prescription drugs. We talk about rising drug costs and next steps here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Under the legislation, according to Kaiser Health News, Medicare could start the new pricing procedures next year, with the head of Health and Human Services identifying up to 10 drugs subject to this arena of bargaining. Join in on how you'd feel about government price setting, what drugs that you think should be first in line, the potential impact to cost. 800-642-1234. Dr. Nicole Schreiner is Clinical Services Manager and co-owner of Strews Pharmacy in Green Bay. She's been with the pharmacy since 1998. Chairs the Community Pharmacy Advisory Committee, part of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin. Dr. Schreiner, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me here this morning.
So as you look at this proposal, negotiating prescription drug prices directly with pharma, I just wonder, what are your thoughts here? Because how would this impact patients and people who use these meds?
Well, a lot of thoughts have actually gone through my mind as I've been processing and learning more about the proposed bill. And one of the things I would like listeners and patients to understand is that the whole pricing spectrum for how the medications get from the manufacturer to the patient is a very convoluted process with a lot of different hands in the cookie jar and a lot of different players. And so I think that's very important to kind of understand that. So we have Medicare, and then we have pharmacy benefit managers, then we have insurance companies, we have drug wholesalers, we have generic drug companies, we have the manufacturers of the branded products, and then we have other things like rebates coming into it from manufacturers and from the wholesalers. And then you have after transaction fees being assigned to pharmacies. So as you can see, it is a very convoluted process. So trying to influence any one area of that can not necessarily mean direct savings to the patient.
It makes me wonder, are there enough seats at the table to try to pull apart this pricing juggernaut?
It's actually a very good question, because we've tried in the past to make some progress for this. I do think one of the areas that I reviewed in this bill was that they were proposing, it's my understanding, of a maximum out-of-pocket, a $2,000 per patient. So obviously that sort of is a more global, all-encompassing for the patient, to give that direct savings to the patient. As an owner of a pharmacy, I have concerns that that savings that the patient will get will be actually taken out of reimbursement to pharmacies, which is already very low to pharmacies. Pharmacies oftentimes find that they have claims that they get reimbursed less than cost on those products. So it's a very competitive market.
When was the last time reimbursements to pharmacies, that rate was changed?
Well, it changes often, but goes down normally. It has not necessarily gone up in, I don't remember the last time we've necessarily seen increases in those. The other big thing that pharmacies are trying to lobby for is that we would know what we're actually being reimbursed at the time of the transaction. Because one of the major things is we get reimbursed, money taken back from us after the transaction occurs, and we call these DIR fees. So we don't even actually know what we're getting sometimes at the time of the transaction to the patient.
Wow. Talking about drug prices, how these costs are formed and what the future holds to reduce the cost of healthcare. Dr. Nicole Schreiner, with her perspective, clinical services manager, co-owner of a community pharmacy in Green Bay. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What have you seen with your own drug prices? What do you make of federal regulation and negotiation on drug prices? And is this even possible in our free market economy? 800-642-1234. Dr. Schreiner, a pharmaceutical industry campaign says a proposal like this would limit Medicare's access to drugs, and patients would be stuck with a limited variety of medication that they can get access to. Is that true?
I don't know that it would actually, and I guess that waits to be seen, but in my opinion, I'm not sure that would actually be much different than what we currently see. Almost every insurance plan has what they call a preferred list of medications, and so, or formulary. And so patients are restricted to use medications on that list already. So I'm not sure it's a much different model than what we're already currently seeing in practice. I did want to go back and comment also on where we had talked about that this new bill would allow Medicare to negotiate prices directly with manufacturers. And you had mentioned that this is only about 10 drugs that's being, is my understanding, being allowed for them to look at. And keep in mind, like my pharmacy is a relatively, you know, local pharmacy, but we carry over 2,000 unique products in our inventory. And
wow.
So 10 is a very small
starting
amount.
Point. Yes.
Yeah.
It would have to be 10 of some very common, widely used medications, I would imagine, like, for instance, and we can go here later, insulin. But I want to ask you, you know, nationwide spending on prescription drugs increased from $30 billion in 1980 to $335 billion in 2018. That's from the Congressional Budget Office. So in your decades of experience as a pharmacist, how do you explain the price increases to your patients, to your customers?
Yeah, difficult, because as I stated at the very beginning, it's a very difficult obtaining process for us to get that product to the end user, which is the patient. It does make sense that we have increased our costs. We have seen major advancements in biologic agents treating hepatitis C, for instance, where that didn't exist 10 years ago, and we're curing hepatitis C now. We have major advancements in treating diabetes and other autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. So we are making advancements, and unfortunately, these drugs are very expensive.
Are drug companies increasing their prices as also, you know, in addition to the R&D as a response to increased cost and in inflation?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. My perspective on the drug companies is, yes, they're definitely a player, as are the pharmacies in this whole process of getting cost-effective medications to the end user, to the patient. But they also need to get reimbursed for the number of medications that don't make it to market because of research and development. And we do have to remember that the U.S. is one of the primary leaders in development of pharmaceutical products. I think, like I said, there's so many middlemen in between there, like drug wholesalers and insurance companies and pharmacy benefit managers, that we need to be cognizant of every step in that process and in that chain that influences prices, because everybody wants to get their share, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Dr. Nicole Schreiner, pharmacist in Green Bay with us, former board member on the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin Board of Directors, served on the Long-Term Care Board. Join in on what you think could curb prescription drug costs, what you've encountered personally, what the donut hole feels like in Medicare drug plan coverage gaps. 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, back in a minute with Dr. Schreiner here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on drug prices and federal legislative policy that would enact government price negotiations for prescription drugs, allowing Medicare to negotiate directly with drug makers with pricing that would take effect in 2026 under this proposal. Still time to talk about costs of your meds, your view of pharma, what you've done to afford your meds, 800-642-1234. Pharmacist Nicole Schreiner is Clinical Services Manager, co-owner of Strews Pharmacy in Green Bay, with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Ed now in Lake Mills. Ed, hi. What is on your mind?
Well, this, in terms of the high cost of medication in the United States, I have a feeling that part of the cost is due to the fact that manufacturers provide medication throughout the world. Much of the world is under socialized medicine, where their governments are telling the drug companies, here's how much we will pay you for your product. And so the drug manufacturers, when they accept that amount from other places in the world and they say, well, that's not covering the nut, is there anywhere we can go that we can tell the, you know, charge a price that will make us a profit? And they go say, well, there's a free market in America. And so the price of medications in America is higher because they have to cover the cost of doing business with the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And since America tends to be the largest provider of medications, I mean, the biggest user of medications in the world, I don't know why we can't have a system where it's like, okay, so America gets the best price from the manufacturers, and if other countries need help paying for medications, then they have to come to the United States for foreign assistance type of a situation.
Ed, thank you. I want to pause here and allow Dr. Schreiner to respond on what is that best path forward when we have a free market approach to pharma, unlike much of the rest of the world.
I think that Ed makes a good point that is true. Unfortunately, we are one of the primary innovators of products, but we're also one of the primary users of those innovative new products. There are countries out there that can't even afford to use some of the products that we use. For instance, I do some nonprofit work with Uganda, and they don't use any branded products just simply because patients can't afford that. And so, yes, there is to a certain point, the US is paying for a lot of the marketing of those products that are being used within other countries. So I think that is part of it. But like I said, it's just such a very complicated process of how we pay for medications in this country.
Ed, thank you. Mike now in Grafton. Mike, go ahead.
The doctor's impression or opinion about, you know, the fact of how much medication the United States uses relative, you know, on an individual basis relative to other developed countries, and then the outcomes analysis and the lack of, you know, life expectancy that we have relative to those same countries.
Mike, thank you. Were you able to catch that, Dr. Schreiner?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. So this is kind of probably a little bit of old data, but on average, a senior patient is on average about 10 medications, of which one or two of those could be considered like an over-the-counter, like an aspirin or like a vitamin D for bone health. And then at least one to maybe two branded products in that mix. So one of the things that in pharmacy that we've been fighting for, he talked about outcomes. Pharmacy has been fighting for pharmacists to be viewed as providers in the eyes of the federal government. We are currently not. So we get paid for the prescription, but we do not get reimbursed for our professional services. And we are trying to say we are outcomes driven. We want to be part of the total package of healthcare and taking care of patients, but that takes time and efforts and labor. And we just want to be reimbursed for those things that we're doing and be seen as being able to do those things. So the pharmacies like ours have been providing blood pressures and vaccinations and other services that we, quite frankly, just don't get reimbursed for. And we, you know, I think the caller's point is we are spending a lot on medications. I think one of the primary causes for hospitalization is not taking your medication properly.
You know, one of the things that comes to mind that pharmacists do is looking very closely at the meds of someone and finding conflicts between two different medications and raising that potentially as an issue. But as you say, there are a lot of other different pieces here that the pharmacist is doing and then not seen as a provider in the process.
Correct. Yeah. There is one area that has been wonderful that insurance companies have valued pharmacy and pharmacists is what we can do called comprehensive medication reviews. And our state, Wisconsin, has been very progressive with paying for certain disease states to have those interventions made with a pharmacist. And at that time, pharmacists are able to meet with patients, assess adherence, look at duplications of therapy, possible drug-drug interactions, as well as whether there's opportunities to do what we call deprescribing or get rid of medications that may not be needed anymore or add something, you know, based on guidelines. So that has been wonderful that we have had that opportunity in the state of Wisconsin. And now there are also some other insurance companies are opening that up and paying for that service also.
Talking about balancing the cost of prescription drug prices and treatment with Dr. Nicole Schreiner, a pharmacist in the Green Bay area, former board member on the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin board. You can join in on drug costs as you see them in your experience, 800-642-1234. Dr. Schreiner, as we talked earlier about what happens abroad with prescription drugs, you know, we have also seen here in the U.S. people ordering their prescriptions online from other countries or overseas at much less expensive pricing. What would you say there?
Yeah, I think my comment to that is I think people are desperate to be able to make their medication costs affordable and able to incorporate that into their budget. And I think that they're so desperate that they're looking for any opportunity to be able to do that. I can only comment on what I believe is that the United States holds the best standards of manufacturing processes. I know that manufacturers are held in the US to a very high degree of standards and what we call good manufacturing processes. I can't comment to what other countries do for that just because that's not part of our training. And so, you know, you always question what is the quality of that product and, you know, but I think like you said, it's patients just really want to try to make ends meet.
Let's go to Jim in River Falls. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for having this program. Yeah, I just wanted to mention, and I think on one of the afternoon programs at one point, they had Dr. Marty McCary on. He wrote a book called The Price We Pay, What Broke the American Healthcare, and how to fix it. He's out of Johns Hopkins. He's a surgical oncologist out there. But your guest is mentioning, you know, how complicated our healthcare system is and the middlemen and pharmaceutical managers. And, you know, they try to get as much as they can out of the price of these drugs for, you know, for personal benefit and wealth. And not all hospitals pay the same prices or pharmacies. It's not a very fair system. And there's you know, a lot of middlemen that are extracting a price on American healthcare patients here. So, and I guess another thing is, you know, we don't focus enough on preventative medicine in this country, which would probably cut down on cost overall for our country of what we're paying for healthcare.
Jim, thank you. Dr. Schreiner, in the seconds that we have left, your thoughts on Jim's observations.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. As I tried to state at the, when I first started, this is a very, very complicated process, and simplifying it would be absolutely fantastic. And I think the drug cost is one of the things, but we also even need to look at what, like right now, what's happening with steering patients to particular pharmacies, rather than giving patients the freedom of choice to choose a pharmacy that provides compliance packaging, delivery services, or charge accounts, forcing the use of mail order, or charging higher copays to using a non-preferred pharmacy. So I think we need a more comprehensive approach, and not, we can't just look at it piecemeal.
Hmm. Dr. Schreiner, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Nicole Schreiner, Clinical Services Manager, co-owner of Strews Pharmacy in Green Bay. Ahead, we continue our conversation about the cost of healthcare and treatment with a lead author of a new Kaiser Health investigation. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the 100 million people in America under the burden of healthcare debt in a new investigation by Kaiser Health News and NPR. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The upshot here, our healthcare system produces debt on a massive scale, and that's forcing families to make really difficult sacrifices. We'll get deeper on that. Join in with your story about medical debt, what you've learned, how you've managed it, and your state now, 800-642-1234. Noam Levy is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, lead investigator into this reporting partnership with NPR that looked at the scale and impact of medical debt. It's called Diagnosis Debt. Noam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
So your survey, as I mentioned there, estimates more than 100 million Americans have medical debt, and this includes bills and collections and medical debt that you have pushed over to credit cards, family members helping pay up. Who are the people with medical debt?
So one of the really kind of terrifying things about, I think, medical debt in this country is the broad reach of the problem. I mean, as you might expect, people who have lower incomes, people who don't have health insurance are more likely to have medical debt. It is not to the poorest and the least protected. We found large proportions of people making more than $100,000 a year have medical debt. Most people in America who have medical debt have health insurance. So this is a problem that sort of touches every corner of this country.
Just because you have health insurance doesn't mean you're not going to get slammed with thousands upon thousands of dollars of bills that you certainly may not have saved up to pay for, is what I'm hearing.
I mean, one of the things which we asked about was whether or not people had $500 to pay an unexpected medical bill. And half of U.S. adults said they don't have that cash readily available. So when you combine that with the fact that more and more people are in health insurance plans that require thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket spending before the coverage kicks in, you're going to have a problem.
Throw some numbers at us. What is the average amount of medical debt? What did this investigation find?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Oh, sure. I just said if you could throw some numbers at us at what is the average amount of medical debt and what your investigation found there.
Sure. So a lot of people have relatively, I guess one might say, relatively smaller amounts of debt, about a third owe less than $1,000. But we found that one in four who have medical debt owe at least $5,000. One in 10 who have medical debt owe at least $10,000. And many of these people don't expect to ever be able to pay that money back, essentially resigning themselves to being shadowed by this debt forever.
And, you know, I want to ask you, too, how has the higher inflation and hospital systems justified, you know, raising prices and expecting patients to pay up when those bills come due?
Well, one of the things which one hears from hospitals and other medical providers is that they have high costs and they have to pass those costs on to somebody. And this is true. In some respects, we have the highest priced medical system in the world on a per unit cost compared to other high income countries around the world. It costs more to get your knee replaced in the United States than anywhere else. It costs more an MRI. It costs more to get most prescription drugs here than it costs anywhere else. And those high prices traditionally were covered mostly by health insurance. And one way that employers and others have responded to these rapidly rising medical prices is to raise premiums. We all know that the amount that comes out of our paychecks that go toward health insurance has been rising pretty relentlessly for decades. And one thing that has also sparked is, as I mentioned earlier, this high deductible solution, if you will, this incredible rapid growth in high deductible high health plans. Now, if you look 15 or 20 years ago, most health plans had maybe a couple hundred dollars as a deductible before your insurance kicked in to cover most of the costs. Now, the average deductible is about $1,500 for a single plan, and it can be $5,000 or $10,000 for a family plan. So the underlying prices of medical care have translated health works, and that in turn has pushed more costs onto patients themselves.
Noam, we're having some trouble with your connection, some instability. So we've been losing some words. We're going to reconnect here by phone as we look at the millions of Americans with medical debt after this new investigation by Kaiser Health News and NPR found more than 100 million Americans are grappling with paying off healthcare bills. Is this you? Join in at 800-642-1234. What have you encountered with your medical bills? Have you gone to collections? Have you had to negotiate with a hospital? Do you know how to negotiate with a hospital? And did it lower the ultimate price? Do you look line by line when you receive statements on your medical bills? And do they match up? When do you ask questions? Join in the conversation about medical debt, 800-642-1234. Noam Levy is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Noam, on a better line here, on the old telephone now.
Yeah, good to be with you. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. One of the people who are in medical debt who you talked with, a cancer diagnosis, and I was hoping you could bring us into the life of Jenny Ray Peters. What did Jenny Ray Peters encounter with cancer?
So Jenny Ray is a single mom in Rapid City, South Dakota. She's 44 years old. She is a mental health counselor in that city in Western South Dakota, and she's a foster mom. She's been taking in foster kids for the last few years, and she's adopted two daughters just a little more than 2 years ago. And in the spring of 2020, just as COVID was descending on all of us, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And like many people who get cancer, she went through a sort of exhausting regimen of chemotherapy and radiation. She had seven surgeries, including a mastectomy. She had her ovaries removed after she was found to be at elevated risk of other cancer. And through this process, she had health insurance through her employer, but the bills piled up because of the deductibles and the cost sharing that the hospitals and the anesthesiologists and the others charged her. And she ended up with about $30,000 in medical debt that she's living with now. And, you know, needless to say, she's not getting wealthy being a mental health counselor, and being a foster mom doesn't come with a lot of money either. So she's basically been living with collectors calling her and sending her bills almost since she was diagnosed with cancer. And she said one of the things she told us was that, you know, when she was diagnosed, she was terrified, of course, that these children she was getting taken care of would once again lose a parent. Now, thankfully, she's recovered, but she said she worries about what she'll be able to do for her kids because the money's so tight because of these medical bills.
I would imagine every call, every bill that comes in the mail that is not paid is a reminder not only of that cancer, but of the potential instability of her financial situation and what her children might encounter.
You know, anybody who's gotten a medical bill or a collection notice for anything, for a medical bill or a cell phone or what have you, I think can relate that it's a stress-inducing experience. And many people I've talked to in the course of doing this investigation who get medical debt describe not even opening mail and just putting it to the side because they know they can't handle it because it causes so much stress. And one of the really pernicious, I think, impacts of medical debt, particularly on people who have a disease like cancer, is that this stress is coming at their most vulnerable time. People are fighting a life-threatening illness. And there is actually now evidence that that stress can actually impact people's recovery from a disease and even hasten their death. It's a pretty barbaric feature, I think, of our healthcare system.
Mm. Let's bring in Brenda in Milwaukee. Brenda, what can you share about your situation, your story?
Well, about a year ago, I had an ultrasound. And when I checked my bill, it was basically a charge ultrasound times two. And I was confused. And I thought, well, I know I was there. So I called the hospital, and they said that that's what I had. And I said, no, it's not. And I argued their point about it. Then I said, you need to take off that charge. And they said, well, we can't. And I said, well, how did this happen? Evidently, it was coded wrong, so therefore I was charged. So besides me losing my mind, I ended up getting it taken off. It was not easy, but it was taken off. And so it pays truly to be an advocate for yourself. I never thought this would happen.
Coming down to a coding error, Noam, what can you tell us about what Brenda has gone through here?
So unfortunately, Brenda's experience is not at all unique. When you talk to people who work in the debt collection industry or have worked in the debt collection industry, they'll tell you that the ballpark assumption is that up to a third of medical bills that end up in collections in some way entail some kind of an error. Somebody might be billed twice for something. They might be billed for a service they never received. They might be billed for somebody else's service. And the tough thing about this is when people see these kinds of errors, they will sometimes try to dispute them with the hospital or the medical provider, or maybe they don't deal with it, hoping that it will get worked out between an insurance company and a hospital. And if it doesn't, it will end up going to collections. Collections can sometimes lead to the debt getting to a collection agency, getting on somebody's credit report, or, you know, in the worst case scenarios, the debt is sold to somebody. People can be sued. It's a big problem.
Brenda, after this experience, how do you look at your medical bills now?
Oh, with a fine-tooth comb. And also, if I know I am going to get a shot, this may sound silly, but I literally bring my own bandages because I don't want to get charged $5, or they don't even mark it there of what they charge for that particular thing. It's just maybe like incidentals or something ridiculous like that. But I know that they're going to charge me for that. I dislocated my shoulder. I didn't get a sling because I knew it wouldn't hold my arm up like it should. and I didn't want to be charged God knows how much money for that. So I look at everything with a fine-tooth comb, and I'll even call the hospital and say, what does this mean? What is this charge on this?
Brenda, so much to think about there. Noam, what do you make of that strategy there?
So I think what Brenda's doing is smart. A lot of times patients don't know that they can request itemized bills to understand what is actually going on. That can lead to corrections in some cases. But I think, you know, what a statement about our healthcare system that she feels that, A, she needs to go through it with a fine-tooth comb, something that if you've ever had a long medical bill for a complex procedure, there can be literally hundreds of billing codes on these bills. Most physicians wouldn't be able to get through something like that and understand what's actually in there. And secondly, I mean, it's remarkable that she feels she has to bring her own bandages. I mean, this is something we hear about in the developing world.
Kaiser Health News senior correspondent Noam Levy with us led an investigation into the soaring medical debt Americans hold, the scale, the impact, the causes. Join in on how you think medical debt could be fixed in our country. What steps you'd take? What scares you about your medical bills piling up? 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about medical debt. One of the voices in the Kaiser Health News investigation is a nurse practitioner in Chicago, Ellison Ward. Her twin boys were premature, spent months in the hospital's NICU. This was a decade ago. Their family got hit with about $80,000 in medical debt.
I mean, I think cruel is the word to describe it, because no one should have to think, okay, well, what if I get sick with something that's completely out of my control and I don't have a way to deal with my sickness without in some ways going completely bankrupt or affecting my financial health of our family for the rest of our lives.
Join in 800-642-1234. Noam Levy, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, lead investigator in this project, Diagnosis Debt, with us for about six more minutes. Noam, your reporting project surveyed more than 2,300 people, interviewing hundreds. We just hear there, Allie, with her story. What sticks out to you?
I've been covering healthcare for almost 15 years in this country. And so it's not a surprise to me, and I'm sure it's not a surprise to many of your listeners, that medical bills are expensive and people struggle to pay them. I think the one thing that really struck me and some of the other researchers on our project was just the scale of the suffering out there. I mean, you heard just now, you played Allison Moore, this nurse practitioner in Chicago, and you know, she and her husband and her two boys are doing okay health-wise. Thankfully, her kids, even though they were born early, have recovered. They're playful 10-year-olds now. The couple owns their home, but you know, they still have about $10,000 in medical debt hanging over them 10 years later. And you talk to people who just live with, even if they haven't suffered the worst impacts of medical debt, like losing their home or declaring bankruptcy, which happens with disturbing frequency, people are shadowed by this stress and strain, and people put up with it. And they a lot of times tell me, I can't believe what people who aren't as fortunate as I am would do in this situation. And you know, these are people who maybe they're not able to save for retirement, so they haven't dealt with the worst impacts of having to pay these medical bills, or they haven't been able to put the money away for their kids, for their education. These small, in some ways, imperceptible ways that debt that is created by our healthcare system is holding people back from doing the things that they want to do in their lives.
What is the solution then? Where do we go from here? What would you suggest?
So there have been some proposals and some initiatives to restrain the sort of worst excesses of debt collection in the healthcare industry. The credit rating agencies earlier this year announced that they would remove some bad credit marks having to do with medical bills from people's credit reports.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to tell you that, you know, the United States stands out not from other wealthy countries, not so much in, you know, whether we have single payer healthcare or not. There are some countries like Canada and the UK that do have single payer, but there are many other wealthy countries in the world that don't have single payer healthcare, don't have government healthcare. They have private health insurance systems, private doctors, et cetera. But the thing that really stands out here is the amount of bills that we as a country are willing to tolerate people getting for their medical care. Basically, every other country, no matter how they organize their healthcare systems, caps how much people can be expected to pay, so that when you're in Germany and you go to the pharmacy, you're not going to pay more than 10 euros for a prescription. Now, Germany is a country that has private health insurance. But the Affordable Care Act, which passed, you know, more than 10 years ago now, did put some restraints on how much people could be billed for medical care. But those limits are very high, $8,000 or more. And people simply cannot afford that. And so most of us are living essentially one emergency or one diagnosis of cancer or some other chronic disease away from going into debt. And I think until we're sort of willing to confront the fact that the majority of us cannot pay thousands of dollars out of pocket for medical care and put caps on that somehow, we're going to continue to be shadowed by medical debt.
We have less than a minute left, but if you could give us one piece of advice as we look at a medical bill and we see so many numbers on that medical bill, maybe it's multiple pages, what advice would you give us?
Don't be afraid to call the hospital and say, I want to understand what is in here. I want to know what these
services
are. Walk you through what that would look like.
Or, no, as I was saying, you know, walk me through this when you call the hospital.
Yes. Ask to speak to someone who will walk through that, because there may be errors in there. There may be things to do. The other thing I would say is don't be afraid to ask for assistance. Most hospitals and all nonprofit hospitals have to have financial assistance programs. And these hospitals are supposed to make this financial aid process easy and easy to find for patients. Many of them do not. So you sometimes have to ask for it, and you sometimes have to ask again and again. But even if you make 3 or 4 or 5 times what the federal poverty level is, pretty middle class wage in a lot of parts of this country, you still could qualify for financial assistance. So don't be afraid to ask for it, and keep asking for it if you don't get the answer that you want right away.
Noam, thank you for joining us and sharing your reporting.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for your interest in this issue.
Noam Levy, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, lead investigator into diagnosis debt. This is the reporting partnership with NPR. We have a link to it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.